We've just been listening to a report about the situation in Fresno, California, regarding level of food insecurity there, and certainly as an extension, a lack of food sovereignty, I'm sure. What's the difference between the situation in terms of food sovereignty, food security here in the United States and in other parts of the world in terms of the causes and the potential solutions?
Well, surprisingly, the causes of hunger and food insecurity in the U.S. and around the world are the same. The proximate causes differ, but the root causes are the same. And the cause basically resides in the fact that we have a global food system which is highly vulnerable to both environmental and economic shock, and is controlled by a handful of monopolies and oligopolies, the grain companies, the big retailers, the big seed companies. They basically control the price and flows and type of food and seeds and agricultural products, which are grown and commercialized around the world. And so it's that centralized monopolistic control and that high level of vulnerability which puts people at risk of hunger or plunges them into hunger. The reason that people go hungry is not because of lack of food. They go hungry because they can't afford it and because their governments are unable to respond to this contradiction. Basically, what you have in the Central Valley of California, and this has been documented for decades, is sort of the immiseration of people who work at the heart of the global food system. So ironically, both in California and in sub-Saharan Africa, those who actually work the land are those who are going hungry and who are most food insecure.
You just mentioned that the farmers and the farm workers are often those suffering from food insecurity and going hungry, and that's something I was going to mention. But as well, the people who live in that area, and specifically in Fresno County and the Central Valley, are very unhealthy and don't have access to good food. How does that work? That doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, no, of course, it doesn't make any sense, and it's certainly inequitable and unfair, and actually a gross violation of human rights. But this is an old story. If you go back to 1947, when Wally Goldschmidt wrote his classical piece called As You Sow, and he looked at three towns in the Central Valley. And what he found was he very closely compared two of them. And he compared a town in which there were small to medium-sized farms, local processing, and a lot of local businesses. And he looked basically at the levels of livelihoods and food security. And he compared that to another town, which had large industrial farms, right? Both the same in population and the same in demographics and whatnot. He found that the town with industrial agriculture had abysmal levels in livelihood indices and levels of food security. So people were going hungry on the plantations of the Central Valley even back then, when we still had a lot of small farms all through the Central Valley. If you compared the small farm towns with the industrialized farm towns, you find that the modern industrialized farm towns were the ones where you had the highest indices of human immiseration. That's even more true today, because on one hand, we've industrialized pretty much the entire Central Valley, and we've gone through several major structural changes on this continent. And one, I guess, is the industrialization of agriculture. This has happened all over the world, and it happened in our Central Valley. And this concentrates the power of production, processing, and distribution into very few hands. Two, we have the structural adjustment policies of the 1980s. And these structural adjustment policies basically made countries of the global south open up their markets to overproduction coming out of the United States and Europe that was subsidized and then dumped into these countries in the global south, including Mexico. and putting those farmers out of business. So what we then have is waves and waves of migration from Africa to Europe, from Latin America to the United States, of basically rural people whose livelihoods have been destroyed by quote-unquote free markets. They're not exactly free because the products in the north are subsidized and the products in the south are not, so they can't compete. So we have them coming in waves into the Central Valley, and agriculture has always been the point of entry for the labor market, immigrant labor market. And so what happens is you have waves of very poor immigrants coming in to areas of industrial agriculture. Wages are horribly depressed, right? And there's no way to establish a tax base. Many of these people are undocumented. Many of them have to double up, triple up, quadruple up on housing in order to house themselves and feed themselves under these immiserating conditions of labor and very, very low wages. And then what happens is they have to travel outside of their communities in order to buy food and obtain services. So the dollars that they do spend don't end up getting spent in the communities and don't end up getting reinvested. So basically you have the extraction of wealth from land and labor in these areas of high immigration rate. And what the studies show, and the recent studies show, is that these towns are not capitalizing. You know, one would expect the American dream, well, the first year, the first generation, it's tough, but then the second generation, the kids get a leg up and maybe you establish a restaurant and maybe someone goes to school or gets to college or whatnot. And over time, you're able to accumulate, buy a home, establish a tax base in the town and whatnot. This is not happening. What we've done is through structural adjustment and then through the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, you know, cement the structural adjustment policies into international law, into international treaty, overriding national law. Waves of immigrants are forced to leave, economic refugees, leave their livelihoods in the countryside, and then come up here. And what we've done is we've both, on one hand, worsened the poverty in the global south, and then transferred it to these pockets of poverty in our high industrialized, high productivity areas in the global north. And this is true for the San Joaquin Valley, and it's true across the United States. If you look at the meat processing sector, for example, the poorest people in the world are the ones who chop up our meat. One of the most dangerous jobs in the country, working on the slaughterhouse floor or deboning. Horrible injuries all the time because the lines move so quickly. And those people don't get compensated at all. And these are the people who are most at risk of food insecurity, hunger, and then all of the diet-related diseases, which have now become an epidemic in this country.
When we talk about hunger here in the U.S., quickly we start talking about nutrition. And this country is famous or infamous for being overweight, eating fast food, and not being very healthy. Some people, a lot of the ones you were just talking about, they can't afford healthy food or they don't have access to it in the towns they live in. And when we look at how we got into this situation, a lot of it has to do with getting away from eating local foods and eating natural foods with the rise of the industrial farms, things we've been talking about, large-scale agriculture and distribution. So I'm wondering, in the days when we used to eat locally, when it was small-scale farms, even if it wasn't by choice, did we, meaning people here in the United States and in other parts of the world, did we know we were eating healthy, or were we just accidentally eating healthy because that's what was around? I'm asking because I'm wondering do we need to relearn nutrition or as a society, or do we need to learn it for the first time around? Did we ever know we were eating healthy, or is it just that's what we had access to?
Well, I mean, the United States has always been, since its inception as a nation, has always been a combination of many food and agricultural cultures, right? And the, in many ways, over the years, the best of those traditions were kept and new ones were improved upon. And so, yes, I think in general, there were times where we had a much healthier diet, and certainly a much more diverse diet, not so highly based on grain-fed beef and high-fructose corn syrup, which is mostly what we consume today. You see this around the world. I mean, and this has been destroyed. I mean, there's a new, well, not so new, but there's the a new rice variety that's been developed, a genetically engineered variety called golden rice, which has vitamin A injected into it for the carotene, so that people don't suffer vitamin A deficiency and go blind. Well, there's two problems with that. You know, one is to eat enough rice to get your minimum vitamin A daily requirement is, you know, several kilos of rice, something like 4 kilos of rice. Well, no one can consume that much. But the second thing is, no one asked the question, why are people now suffering vitamin A deficiency? And it's because their diet has been taken away from them. They don't eat the leafy greens anymore. They don't eat the wide variety of fruits and vegetables that they used to, because everything has been turned into monocultures. And that's happened in this country as well. I mean, if you look at the supermarket aisle, if you look at the packaging, it seems incredibly diverse until you actually read the ingredients in the packages. And you'll find that 90% of it is based on high fructose corn syrup. We're basically eating corn syrup. They've done analysis on the body and find that we actually, in the United States, have higher levels of corn in our body than people in Central America and Mexico, which is the cradle of corn civilization. They call themselves the hombres de maíz, the people of corn. But in fact, we are now the people of corn syrup. I think it's to change this, you know, one has to, on one hand, address our habits, relatively new habits, but very strong nonetheless, of eating so poorly. But one also has to address the structural issues. I mean, one, good food is hard to find, particularly if you live in underserved communities, either in urban areas or rural areas. You have to travel miles and miles to find fresh, healthy food, fruits and vegetables. Bad food is cheap because we subsidize corn so highly, and that makes it a base for processing all of these really very dangerous foods which are made available to us. So on one hand, we have to change these structures. On the other hand, people don't have time anymore. Our wages are so low that people have to work two jobs, both and the man and the wife, and often the elder children's have to work. So who has time to cook? Right? So I think, you know, it's really many-sided. On one hand, we need decent wages if we expect to address the problem of malnutrition and diet-related diseases. People have to be earning enough to be able to pay for good food. We also have to cut out the middleman. It used to be that farmers in this country got at least 50%, 60% of the food dollar. Now they get much less than 20, and with that they have to pay for their costs of production, for other inputs. That's just gross. It's not net. So, you know, what's happening in between? Well, that's where we have the agri-foods corporations, the huge monopolies that are dominating our food system. And on one hand, they provide us the cheap food, but it's only cheap at the cash register. It's very expensive on our health. It's very expensive to the nation's health bill, right? And it's very expensive in terms of the environment. We're making the land overproduce. We make land overproduce by pumping nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and other fertilizers, pumping water into the land, and then overproducing, sending the surplus overseas to ruin agricultural production in the countries of the global south, and then using the rest of the processing the rest of the surplus, either in the form of grain-fed beef or in the form of processed foods, cheap processed foods. So I think we have to go back to, on one hand, treating the land better, paying farmers more directly to eliminate the middleman, paying higher wages to people, especially people all through the food system, starting with the farm workers and the processors and the drivers and everybody else, and people who work in retail at a place like Walmart, for example. And then we do have to change our habits.
So for the average person here in the U.S., maybe not average, but for someone who feels they actually can afford a reasonable amount of healthy food, what kind of actions can they take besides calling members of Congress when a piece of legislation comes up? Is having a garden the solution? Is it shopping locally? Is it eating in season? What are the decisions people can make personally? And on what kind of a scale would those have to happen to really start to change the system?
Well, the answer is of course, all of the above. And I think so many of the things that are happening today are the right things. They're the things we need to be doing. The farmers' markets, the CSAs, community-supported agriculture, attempting to buy, process, distribute, and consume more locally, keeping the food dollar in the community as much as possible so that our food systems become engines for local economic development rather than sumps to suck wealth out of communities. All these things have to happen. But I think we're not just consumers. We're also citizens. And that means that we don't just vote with our fork. In fact, we also vote with our votes. And we also vote with our political actions. And so there are two, I think, main political arenas where we can change the rules of our food system so they will favor healthy food over unhealthy food, favor more locally grown food over food which has to travel 2,500 miles from production to consumer, and which favor the deconcentration of power over our food away from the big monopolies and more into the hands of communities. And the two areas of work which are looking very promising. On one hand, you have the Farm Bill, which is really a farm and food bill. Most of the entitlements in the Farm Bill actually have to do with food and food distribution. The biggest hurdle is to realize that it's a food bill. Because at this time, labeling it a Farm Bill means that consumers don't care about it. And farmers in this country are less than 2% of the population, so they can't influence the Farm Bill. So the de facto lobby are the large corporations. They're the ones who determine the rules through the Farm Bill. But if consumers were to see it as a food bill and start beginning to insist on a fairer food bill and a more sustainable food bill and a healthier food bill, then we could introduce changes at the national level, which are actually changes at the international level, because the U.S. Farm Bill determines a large degree the rules for the food system around the globe. The other is to work locally. Here at the Office of Food First in Oakland, California, we are incubating a food policy council. And we've just conducted a study on food policy councils. It's called Food Policy Councils Lessons Learned. And we interviewed dozens of food policy councils around the United States that have sprung up over the last couple of years, really over the last 10 years, in which citizens working either at the city, county, and even the state level have decided that they're going to change the rules to the extent that they can, working at those levels. They're going to incentivize local production, going to incentivize healthy eating, going to incentivize farm-to-school programs, things like this, incentivize farmers' markets, this type of thing. And it's extremely important and very promising. And I think that You know, changing the rules from the top down and from the bottom up is just as important as changing our habits.
And what about community gardens? In the piece we heard about what's going on in Fresno, that community, at least in the city, was saying, well, this is one of the solutions that can help us. And community gardens are kind of hot right now. And Michelle Obama planted a garden outside the White House. Is that really, I guess you might say it's part of the solution. It seems like it would just have to be on a really large scale to start taking on a multi-trillion dollar system.
Well, that's true, of course. But these are very hopeful developments. And while a community garden may not appear to have a large national impact in the community where you have the garden, it has a significant impact. And it means a lot to the residents of that community. And it means, you know, community gardens aren't just about growing vegetables. These are community events. They're community arenas for political and social discussion and cultural exchange and opportunities for older folks and young people to get together and address the issues of their community and learn together and share. I mean, these are the benefits from community gardens go far beyond just the production of food, though that's obviously very important. If you look worldwide, urban gardens and community gardens are growing at an incredible pace. And in some places, they provide significant amounts of food to the city. The city of Havana, for example, is heavily dependent on its community gardens, on its urban gardens. And they've been a source not only of food, but of employment, because there's processing and recycling that goes on. And these are small businesses. And then you have small fruit and vegetable stands all around the city that actually provide income for the residents engaged in the gardening and then provide healthy food at an affordable price to the residents who are consuming. So while it's true that if you compare it to, you know, the large industries, if you compare it to Walmart or Sodexo or any of these large companies, it appears pitiful. But taken at the micro level, its impact at the micro level, people fight for these gardens. You know, in Los Angeles, when people fought to keep their garden open in South Central and tried to stand up to the bulldozers and against the developers, this wasn't a fight which was about protecting a hobby. This was a fight over livelihoods, over a way of life, a community's way of life. And that's why people fought so hard. And that's why it's scandalous that the mayor of Los Angeles didn't come to their defense.
And what you mentioned about Cuba brings me to my next question. Are there any nations that have really made a marked improvement in how they distribute food and the health of their people as a result? Governments leading the way, or large-scale grassroots movements that have turned an entire society around? And if so, how have they done that?
Well, initiatives coming from governments are very far and few between. However, governments can be persuaded or embarrassed or forced into doing the right thing. And for example, the government of Mali, the government of Ecuador, the government of Venezuela, and several others have adopted in their constitution food sovereignty. And which means that they're not going to allow at least their national food systems to be compromised by global financial interests, by speculators, by the monopolies, that they have the right to protect their national food production. And this has come about primarily from the Worldwide Food Sovereignty Movement, which basically is a movement which was started by Via Campesina, International Peasant Federation, but which now includes fishers and peasant farmers and consumers and everybody basically who has a stake in the food system.
I just have a couple more questions. I want to bring it back here to the United States. What about the current recession? How has that exacerbated or changed the food access problem here in the United States?
The food crisis is much worse because of the financial crisis. And, you know, I think that the way out has not been... the food crisis has been exacerbated by the financial crisis. And unfortunately, the solutions being advanced by the USDA, by USAID, by the World Bank, by the International Monetary Fund, are simply more of the same. More free markets, more production, this time with genetically engineered foods, which supposedly are higher yielding. In fact, they're not. The science shows that they're not. And it's a bit like calling in the arsonists and have them pour more fuel on the fire. It's just making things worse. However, these solutions are being advanced because, in fact, they're very lucrative. In 2008, we had record hunger. We had record harvests. We never produced as much as we did in 2008 on this planet in its history. And we had record profits. 30% increase in profits, quarterly profits, for Monsanto, Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill. Cargill's fertilizer arm, Mosaic Fertilizer, experienced 1,700% increase in profits in the last quarter of 2007 versus 2008. So clearly the food crisis has benefited these companies. And that's why we're getting more of the same as a solution for solving the crisis. I think what we're going to get is more of the same crisis and more concentration of wealth in the hands of these monopolies. I think we have to turn things completely around. What we have to do is, instead of sucking the wealth out of the food system and concentrating it in these monopolies for their shareholders, what we have to do is keep the wealth of the food system in the local food system. We have to keep that food dollar home. You know, most poor folks spend at least $1,000 a year per person on fruits, vegetables, meat, eggs, milk, right? As poor as they are, they still have to eat. Well, that's here in Oakland, in East Oakland, that adds up to quite a bit. That adds up to, you know, maybe $50 million a year. What if that $50 million a year stayed in the community? That could provide jobs, it could provide good food, it could provide tax revenues. You know, it could provide basically economic development.
And about 9 months into the new, 9 months into President Obama's term, do you think, first of all, does he know that the solutions that are being pushed forward are more of the same and aren't working? Does he know that something different has to be tried? And if he does, is he pushing any sort of different solution, both here in the States and as a participant in the international trade agreements, WTO, IMF, as you mentioned?
No, unfortunately, he hasn't really demonstrated any of that kind of leadership. On the contrary, it's been much more business as usual. Michelle Obama has been much more inspirational and much more willing to put herself out there. Because of this has been the subject of the attack and the ridicule of the agri-foods industry, who are furious with her for even using the word organic, much less growing an organic garden and saying we're going to eat healthy here now at the White House. On the other hand, I think you have to say that the food movement in this country in general has made tremendous strides and has gotten these issues on the agenda. And the fact that Michelle Obama puts an organic garden in the White House and is so public about it, I think it has to be considered as a victory.
Eric Holt Jimenez is the executive director of Food First. He's also one of the authors of a new book that just came out titled Food Rebellions, Crisis, and the Hunger for Justice. You can learn more about Food First and that book at foodfirst.org. We'll also link to their website on our site, radioproject.org. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.